Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us on the program. As we come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time, we stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We're rebroadcast on Sundays at 3 p.m. Pacific time on a2zen.fm, and then we archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show page. So you are going to have an opportunity to check out what our guests talk about. We'll have a link to their website, and we hope that you will definitely avail yourself of that as well, because I don't believe in reinventing the wheel. It's already been done, and it works just fine, thank you. Don't need any help from the Dugan clan to try to improve it. It's just fine and round the way it is. I will also tell you that what we do need assistance and support with is with the radio program. So if you can do that, go to the missions page. We have a couple of ways for you to do that, through PayPal and through, I believe it is GoFundMe.com. I think two very secure ways to support the program if you're able to do so. If not, we'll take any energetic support that you can provide as well. Well, today is a day set aside for relating relationships and getting along with one another, but on probably a more intimate level than you might think. We're going to talk today about commitment that we make to our partners. Usually we only have one. Making marriage simple. 10 truths for changing the relationship you have into the one you want. Now think about that. What kind of relationship did you want when you met the person that you're with now? And did you ever think that it was possible, without changing partners, to have the relationship that you want? Well, we're going to find out how that's going to happen. Harville Hendricks is my guest. He's PhD. He's co-author along with his wife, Helen LaKelly Hunt. And Harville is joining us on the program today. And Harville, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry that Helen can't be here, because without her, there wouldn't be Imago or this book, but she couldn't be here today. But I'm glad here to represent both of us, and thank you for having me.
You bet. And our thoughts go to her, and hopefully whatever she's up to, she's enjoying that, and that maybe one day we'll have the two of you on to discuss how this has worked. Now, I have to go back in time as far as I'm concerned. I myself am once divorced. And that's the way it's going to stay. I mean, I'm making that affirmation right now. I have no plans on going through that again. But what I find interesting is that I had, for a period of time, I was listening to a tape series by a gentleman who had created this Maximum Marriage Seminar. And great stuff, funny, and it kept my attention, and I really enjoyed it. And about 10 years ago, I found out he divorced. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Does that completely invalidate everything that he said in his Maximum Marriage seminars or not? And I had to take it with a grain of salt. Look, it happens. You don't know the reasons why he divorced, but he did. I don't think it invalidates the things that he shared in his books and in his tapes and so forth. Because we don't know what's coming tomorrow. To that end, Harville, how can we have the relationship that we want? How can we make that out of what we have that maybe we're not real thrilled with? I mean, I know that's a big question, and obviously that's going to take the entire program. And which is fine, because we need to fill up the hour with something. But it just seems like a really tall order. A lot of folks, they just figure, I'm just going to settle. I don't want to live alone. I'm just going to settle, and I'm going to put up with the way things are.
Yeah. So, well, to transform the relationship you've got, which usually it's not one that you want, into the one you want, which usually you don't have. You have to, there's several ways to put this, but one of the ways is you have to make a sacrifice, or do another word I use called the great extraction. And what I mean by that is that the relationships that we have are usually contain an erosive, toxic quality called negativity. And Negativity is very simply defined as a put down, behaviorally defined as a put down. It's conceptually defined as negativity is negation. And so a put down is a negation in the sense that you make your partner less valuable than you are. You make them less intelligent. You make them less emotional. You make them less by saying things like, "What? Where did you get an idea like that? Why were you late? You're always late. You haven't done your chores or whatever." But you negate your partner. You imbue the relationship with negativity as an attitude, as an action, and often as a behavior. So the great extraction is that you simply have to eliminate negativity. You have to go to zero negativity. And unless you're willing to do that, you can't have the relationship you want because the behaviors that we engage in to get the relationship we want are usually negative behaviors. Like we tell our partners, I wish you were on time more. I wish that you were more intimate. I wish we took more walks. Or worse still, you don't make love to anymore. You don't ever invite me for walks. You. So all of that has to change. It's a radical shift in consciousness and a radical shift in behavior. You have to make that great extraction. Now, I'll talk later, and I don't want to talk too long on one point, about what you have to, that you have to make also the great addition, an input into the relationship. And we can talk about that after we sort of process the great extraction. But that's the first thing. Mm-hmm. If you want the great relationship you want, you have to sacrifice something that you're attached to. And usually it is negativity.
Okay. Well, I know that we have, as a species, gone through various phases where, you know, we'll stay in one period of time, you know, the partners stay together for self-preservation of the family line, if you will. I mean, just to keep that going, period.
Yeah.
But now we're in a phase in our civilization where, you know, we've got 7 billion people. I don't think we need to worry about that anymore. So I'm just going to jump around from person to person until either I find what I'm looking for or I get what I want, and then I'll move on, and I'll get what I want, and I'll move on. And there's no real life. There's no real love. There's no real connection in that regard. And is that what people who are seeking out a partner, that's really what they're looking for? Not so much not to be lonely, but they're looking for connection?
Yes. Yes. I think that's exactly right. Now, loneliness would be a byproduct of disconnection. So that people are not looking so much. Well, I know that's one of the top items came out in a recent research project, that people were looking for companionship. But in our research and our experience over, and if we can just pull rank in terms of years, about 40 years of working with couples, and it's taken a long time to get to get our work reduced to that word, connect. I call it connecting. That what we really, really want is to be, is to experience a felt sense of being with someone else who is a significant partner. And with that partner, we do hang out. They are a companion, and with the loneliness is overcome. But those are qualities. The connection is a felt sense of experiencing being with, being connected to someone else who has a reciprocal feeling about that. And it's like Helen and I have that experience. It's also an experience you can have with other people. And it's a very durable thing. Like I just had lunch today with my best friend, and we are absolutely connected. And one of the things that makes my life with Helen wonderful and my life with my best friend wonderful is that we do not engage in any put downs. There are no negations. Do we have differences? Yes, we have lots of differences. Helen and I differ on nearly everything there is. My best friend and I have agreed only on one or two things that I can recall in about 30 years we've been friends with each other. But those differences are not the criteria for, or needing somebody who's similar or identical with us is not the criteria. And the differences don't really matter. They become, in a sense, we call them the tension of the opposites. They become the opportunities for really, really deep and exciting levels of conversation. And with Helen, who's my partner, that conversation about difference or a conversation about here's what I think and here's what I want become opportunities for co-creation. So when we don't turn difference into conflict, when we don't make the other person bad, when we don't put them down, when we see them as another, we see them not as an object but as a person equal to us, intelligent and beautiful, and we engage with them in our differences, then what happens is co-creation. Out of the tension of the opposites, we'll arrive at some third opportunity or some third option that's better than either one of us brought to the table. And that's a dynamic, living, thriving, wonderful relationship. And it's a piece of what you have to put in. I was talking about the great addition, is that when you remove conflict, you remove negativity. When you put it the other way, when you remove negativity, you remove conflict because you see difference as the possibility of creative tension and co-creation. And what the great thing you have to put into a relationship to make it the relationship you want is you have to put interest into it. You have to put positive energy. Like, for instance, Helen and I have a practice that we do every day, and that is we give each other three appreciations for something you did, a behavior, today. And we make it today so that we won't repeat what we saw yesterday, so that we force our perception, our attention to each other, to something new and novel that's coming up that day. So doing that, I continue to have to pay attention to her. I learn new things about her. I learn more and more each day what an amazing person she is. But I also engage each day in affirming her, in saying to her things that say, your being in the world is not only okay with me, but it's amazing. It's something that I appreciate. Not that I just look at and accept, but I appreciate it. So she lives fundamentally with a safe person, and I live with a safe person. And that safety, and it's reliability and predictability. I can count on her being safe. She can count on me being safe. That's the basis for the experience of what everybody wants, which is connection. So you may find somebody, but in order to have the relationship you want, you have to you really want connection. And to have that, you have to have safety. And to have safety, you have to have zero negativity. So it's sort of that. It sounds like a simple formula, but it's really a profound transformation of your mind and your energy in order to have that reality.
A lot of people also go into relationships with the expectation, which is the first mistake, I think, that person is going to fulfill all their wants, needs, and desires.
Ah.
Now, we're not talking about polyamory here. What we are talking about is that you just spoke of having lunch with your best friend.
Yeah.
Well, gee, I thought your wife was your best friend, and I'm not being critical, but let's talk a little bit about that in terms of the expectations of one person supposedly being the be all and end all for you, and that you don't need any other people in your life.
Yeah. Well, that is a challenging question, and my answer to it may be a bit challenging as well. But I don't see Helen or my best friend as a source of my need supply. That would be to see them as an object, and namely that they are a source of need for me. And if I see them as a need supplier, then they go into the same category, qualitatively different, but somewhat as my doctor or my grocery person. I'm going there to get my needs met. I think the fundamental human need that I have, and it's a human need, and I have this need, is let me put it another way. The fundamental human reality is that we are connection. We are connecting. We are connection. And when that experience of being connected has been ruptured, that then is when we have the fundamental desire, which is the restoration of that connection. And when you are in a relationship where connection is felt, it's not just a thought, we're connected, but an experience of being connected, you actually have all your needs met, except for, you know, food, shelter, clothing. And what happens in a relationship, and you might say, well, what isn't sex a need? Well, I think sex becomes a need when you're not in a connection relationship. Like in mine and Helen's relationship, we make love all the time because of the joy of being with each other, because we're safe for each other. Therefore, we're not wondering when the bomb is going to be thrown. And then we make love whenever we make love all the time, and we have sex sometimes as a result of the making love. It sometimes turns into physical relationship. Most of the time, it's an emotional relationship. It's being with each other. So I think that the thinking that has to happen to have a great marriage is that you have to move out of somebody else being a source for you to you growing to be in relationship with another person, such that what we might consider emotional needs, simply they're all taken care of if you have sustainable connection. Because then, you know, you have great talks. Helen and I have great talks. Sometimes I have this friend whom I just value as a human being. He doesn't meet any of my needs. I just value him as a human being. He's, you know, I enjoy being with him. He's fun to be with. We talk about, you know, his work. We talk about his marriage, talk about his family. But I don't walk away from there saying, I had a need satisfied. I walk away from there with a memory mm-hmm. of an enjoyable moment that I, you know, load in my hippocampus and associate with him and say, no, that was fun. I may not see him for a month, but I'm not needy. I am having a very enjoyable experience of being connected with him. It's a different connection from one with Helen, but the quality, the underlying quality is the same. It's just that there are certain, obviously, differences in a primary partner.
Just out of curiosity, if Helen were to come to you and say, you know what, I don't want you to see that guy anymore. I mean, you want to talk, you come, you talk to me, okay? I'm the only person you need to be talking to.
Yeah.
And I'm not speaking in terms, maybe I'm using the word need is maybe the wrong word, but in terms of having other people in one's life, you know, guys like to get together with guys. Gals like to get together with gals and just hang out. To me, that is sort of meeting the gender connection need in terms of guys doing stuff with. I remember when Tim Allen came out with his television show Home Improvement, as well as his comedy bit, and people just criticized him because he was a woman hater. When, as a matter of fact, that was the farthest thing from what he was trying to get across. He says, look, we have no problem with women, but guys need to be together with guys, too, in addition to. So that's kind of where I'm coming from in that regard.
Yeah.
And I do, by the way, I do understand what you mean when you talk about this whole business of need and the example you gave. I think that's very appropriate. But can we maybe let's go in this other direction here in that regard?
Well, yes, I think there are. I'm not sure there are gender needs. For instance, I don't have a need to hang out with guys, and I'm a guy.
Okay.
I think there are certain communities in which certain rituals exist, and that they're fine and wonderful. So let's say that if Helen said to me, "I don't want you to go have lunch with Norris anymore, my best friend." I would become, the way that I would handle that is I would become very curious about what am I doing with Helen that has ruptured her sense of reliable connection with me. Because she's not going to raise that question unless I have triggered something in her that's made her anxious, meaning that she's become that I've become unsafe for her. So what I would do is would be to engage with her and where does that request come from? And then she might tell me, well, it comes from, you know, something you said or the amount of time that you're structuring with me. So I know something's going on. So what I would do then would be, the important thing would be to restore a reliable safety so that we could restore connection. And I assure you that when Helen and I have a predictable connection, she doesn't care who I have lunch with. Because there is no threat, there's no anxiety. When I do something to produce some anxiety, then it's because the connection is not predictable and reliable. I've broken it in some way. And then that produces anxiety in all of us. Now, you could call that a need that's triggered by something that is core human not existing anymore, which is the experience of connection.
Now, obviously, relationship is a two-way street. There are two people involved, and ergo, yeah, both have to take responsibility for right. what's going on in the relationship. Yeah. In your example here, you automatically assume that it was something that you had done that caused this anxiety in her. I mean, why isn't it possible that maybe it was something that she did that... nothing, it's just something that happened in her day that had nothing to do with you. Is it always assumed that whether it's, because again, we're using the example of you as the male and the female, but it could be reversed as well. Why is it automatically assumed that, oh, I must have done something. What do I need to do? I need to find out what it is that I did that ruptured the connection so that I can reestablish the connection so that she feels safe again, as opposed to she had a lousy day at work and she's just venting.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. And it certainly is the case that it may not be anything that I did. But what so to be accurate about that, what I would become if she suddenly asked me not to see Norris anymore, I mean, that's a very personal request of me.
Mm-hmm.
What I've become then is curious about where does that request come from?
Right.
And I would ask her to help me understand what the fear is behind me seeing Norris. And she might then, you know, share with me that she had a memory that from her childhood in which her father didn't show up for school, or something, you know, it might, but what I've become is curious because what I would know when she makes a request of me that is confining and constricting, or says she don't want to be with me, is that something has happened to interrupt her sense of being safe.
So that's, I see.
And I know that's going on because now she's trying to restabilize the situation by, regulating my behavior. And so that's my trigger it's my cue that I need to pay attention to what the anxiety is here. Where did the lack of safety come from? And then until we can get that restabilized, I may not go see Norris because she's my primary partner.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I know that's a good clarification. Making Marriage Simple, 10 Truths for Changing the Relationship You Have into the One You Want. My guest is Harvel Hendricks, PhD, and he and his wife, Helen, have put together this it's a nice, easy read volume for you to pick up and listen to. And we ask you to pick up our program as it continues here on Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan. Stay tuned.
Stories, I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and we're talking with Harvel Hendricks. And he is the co-author, along with his wife, Helen, of Making Marriage Simple, 10 Truths for Changing the Relationship You Have into the One You Want. Harvel, I want to go back a little bit, if we can, to your parents. And the relationship that they have, how much of what you have incorporated into this volume and obviously into the work that you have done over the years, especially with the PhD and all, how much of that influenced what you have discovered today.
Well, about my parents, I was an orphan when I by the time I was six. So mainly what I have is stories about my father, and mainly stories about my mother, because I don't remember very much. So that I would have to say that one of the contributions of them in the form of their death early in my life would be to make connection and relation and stability very interesting to me. Because, you know, if at six you suddenly are orphaned, you do raise some questions about how safe the world is and how reliable people are. Even if you know they just died rather than abandon you, they nevertheless are gone. So that certainly fed into that. And as a part of my curiosity about the impact of childhood on marriage, which is a part of our theory, I'm very interested in the particular form of that for me. Helen grew up in a very different environment, but had a very similar kind of childhood experience in that her parents were alive but unavailable. And then, so being curious about that was a part of my research about the impact of our parents' marriages, or more exactly, our relationship with our parents' marriages on us in terms of who we select and how we construct our adult relationships ourselves. And there is a pretty strong correlation between early childhood experience and the partner you pick. So is that a sort of response to your question?
Yes. Yes, it is. Because I know that as we, you know, as children, we're picking up all kinds of, I'll call it programming,
yes.
from all different sources. I mean, I even picked up certain lessons, if you will, lessons learned, if you will, from my neighbor friend's parents.
Yes.
You know, and just the neighbors on the other side who didn't have kids at first and then brought three kids into the world. And as far as I know, they're in their 20s or 30s by now. But, you know, you'd watch and you'd hear certain things. You know, I heard that the neighbor who had the pool next door to us, I didn't know he was divorced. But, I mean, the woman he's married to now, oh, she's a wonderful woman. And because divorce was not something that you talked about. I mean, especially
right.
as a Catholic growing up, that was not an option as a Catholic.
Not an option. Yes.
So, you know, we're picking up all kinds of messages from all kinds of different sources. What was it that spurred you into this particular direction as far as relationships? Why did they become so important to Harville?
Oh, well, if you're asking me how did I get into this, I would call it a vocation of being interested in thinking about, writing about, and training therapists. In other words, my vocation was triggered by in 1975. I ended a 16-year marriage, and at the time I did that, I was also a professor at a university in Dallas, Southern Methodist University, on the faculty, on the theology faculty, teaching marriage and family therapy, and pastoral care and psychology of religion, things like that, because I've always been interested in the interface between spirituality and psychology. I ended my marriage. It just died, sort of like, you know, in some ways somebody said to me, sort of like your mother died, the marriage died, the relationship died. And my ex-wife is a fine person, and Helen's ex-husband is a fine person. We met within about a year and a half after our divorces. And I was teaching this course in marriage and family therapy. And the morning that I got my divorce papers, I came back to my seminar, graduate seminar, with students in that course. And they knew where I was coming from. And I was vulnerable with them about that, but they already knew. And they said, we don't want to talk about that. We want to talk about what your divorce triggered in us about our relationships, and which is two of us there were six of us. There were 12 people in the room, and six of those had already experienced a divorce, and they were only 22 years old. And the other six had there were two marriages that were difficult, and two had never had a relationship, and I forgot what the other was. But what they wanted to discuss was, why do you think men and women have so much difficulty being together? And I said, I don't have the foggiest idea. If I did, I wouldn't have this divorce paper in my hand. I mean, I know it theoretically, but sure. I don't know it actually. They said, well, we don't really want you to answer the question. We want to discuss it. And so we engaged in that discussion, and something happened in me in which I felt I was engaged in one of the most important conversations you can imagine, which is, how is it that men and women, the gender balance, the gender difference, which shows up in marriage, how come there's 50% of all people who get divorced are married? Why is the literature in the history of the world about marriage not a happy literature? In fact, if you look at studies of marriage across the centuries, there are all kinds of references to how awful. Usually it was how awful the woman was, because most of the books are written by men. I became really interested in that, and I said to them by the end of the class, this is the most thrilling conversation I think I've ever had, and I want to promise you that I am going to pursue this question until I have a response. It may not be an answer, but it'll be a response that will be satisfactory, make some sense out of this mystery. So I left that. Perkins School of Theology helped me with that project by firing me. So I had a lot of free time. And I was already a therapist, so I went into, I decided I wouldn't pursue graduate, I wouldn't pursue university position anymore, but become a full-time clinician. And I studied couples for 8 years, and the book Getting the Love You Want, which was published in 1988, was my first response to that. And since then, Helen and I have produced 9 other books in which this has become our obsession, to understand couples. And we feel like this is the most important conversation you can have, because couples give birth to children who become citizens of the world, who make the world either a happy or a dangerous place for all of us. And so if we don't have healthy couples, we can't have healthy families, and we can't have a healthy society. So I got really then interested in how can we help the core structure of our civilization be healthy so that we can have a healthy civilization. So it was part of figuring out my own divorce, figuring out my previous marriage, and in the process of doing that, making this discovery that I was working at the core question of human nature and civilization. So I got really excited about that and still with it. And Helen and I are now in the process of launching a global movement to help bring a better relational information and relational technology to couples and families worldwide.
Yeah, now that's the first time I have ever heard of it referred to as technology.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the new kid in town.
That's true. It's the new word. I'm just glad you're not referring to it as quantum relationship solutions. That one got old really fast for me.
I thought,
what was wrong with the old physics that they had to call it quantum? I don't understand. Yes. But I'm not a physicist, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah, there is an answer to that, but we don't have to go into it.
Exactly. So now, just to give our listeners just a bit of a background, your PhD is in?
Well, my PhD is in a joint program of theology and psychology.
Okay.
So my fundamental core discipline has been theological. Then I picked up psychology in graduate school and became a marital therapist, marital theorist. I'm fundamentally a theoretician. And out of that developed a marital therapy called Imago Relationship Therapy, which has become now pretty standard in the culture. Many, many millions of people have read Getting the Love You Want. And we've trained about 2,400 people in Imago Relationship Therapy who are practicing in about 37 countries.
I know often in my radio career, we will sit and talk about a solution to a problem. And invariably, when we get to the end of the conversation, we'll say, well, now that's how it's supposed to work in theory. Now, whether it works in reality, we don't know, but let's give it a shot and see what happens. And I know that that's the same kind of thing that you can sit and you can discuss all you want as to, okay, this is theoretically, this is how this is supposed to pan out. Step one, two, three, four, five.
Yeah.
But you have two incredible variables in a relationship of two. You have two incredible variables.
Yes.
You have no clue as to what they're going to do. How do you get a couple, the individuals of that couple, to a place where, I'm not sure I want to use the word, they're more predictable, but where they understand what it is that you are trying to impart to them to bring their relationship to that place that they want?
Yeah. Well, I love that question. And let me say a pre-answer to it about the relationship between theory and practice. You know, like in theory, it certainly works out, but does it actually work out that way? That one of the things I did in that 8 years of research was I took the position that given that I am divorced and I'm a professor of marriage and family therapy, I obviously don't know anything. So I asked couples, over and over again, after they would set up their problem, what would their solution be? If they could just create a solution, what would that be? And over those 8 years, I listened to couples describe what would have to happen for them to have the marriage of their dreams. And in fact, the couples knew what to do. They just weren't doing it. And nobody had ever put a question to them that enabled them to extract and actualize their own wisdom. So one of the things that came out of that was something very simple. I remember one woman answering the question said, well, I need my husband to listen to me. And I thought, well, I thought that's what he'd been doing. She said, no, he hears me, but he doesn't listen to me. And so I kept inquiring with her and did this with numbers of couples over the years. What would make the difference between hearing and listening? And this woman, who was very articulate, said, well, he would say back to me in some way what I said. Oh, so we would practice that. And so we put together a thing called dialogue, which is a conversation. It's a new way to talk. It has a structure to it. And it replaces what most couples always use, which is called monologue, which is one person talking and nobody listening. And dialogue is one person talking and another person listening deeply, mirroring it back, validating the point of view, and being empathic about another person's experience. So we learn that when you do this, help couples engage in this conversation, what happens is that they begin to feel safe with each other. And that safety helps them then drop their defenses, and then they can move toward each other with more vulnerability and begin to experience what I talked about earlier, is connection. And they begin to language that. And I would hear them say, well, you know, while we're having this conversation and he's listening to me and I'm listening to him and I'm feeling, I'm hearing his empathic words and I'm feeling his empathic feelings, I'm beginning to feel safe here and I'm feeling connected and alive. And I realized that was the sequence. Safety leads to connection, which leads to a feeling of aliveness. And that's what people want, and that's all they want. And when they complain, it's because all of that is gone. So that was one piece, is that I simply hold people in a conversation about what they want until they get it. But I don't let them criticize each other. I hold them, and I trained all Imago therapists in the same way. You hold them in a conversation so that they can hear each other deeply. And what you hear at the bottom of the well is that I just want to feel safe. I just want to feel connected. I want to be able to trust you. I want to be able to you know, that you've got my back. And men say that and women say that. And so after a while, you derive a theory out of that, which then you develop new technologies for. Like I see dialogue as a technology, mirroring, validating, and being empathic. And it's you develop new methods like that that deepen that and go with that. And then the question that I always put to couples when they come to me, first of all, I put them in this conversation. And the question I put to them is, what do you want? If this marriage was just right, what would it be like? And they, and I sit with them until they design their dream marriage. And they always design one in which they're feeling connected and safe and alive. And I mean, they put it in different words, mm-hmm. but that those are the words that, that always hold that. And then I ask them, what would you have to change in your relationship? What would you have to take out of it? What would you have to put into it in order to have that? And they told me, well, we'd have to stop bitching at each other. We'd have to stop putting each other down.
Yeah.
It's like they knew the answer. And what would you have to put into it? Well, we'd have to build each other up. So I took all of those conversations and turned them into an intellectual therapeutic system and then systematized the methodologies of doing that. And it became a theory and a therapy that I could then teach other people to do, and they can do it actually as well as I can.
You know, because go ahead. Because
no, I said it's because there is a structure to it. It doesn't depend totally on being intuitive. There is an actual logical linear structure to it, which works for apparently couples across the world. We're in Estonia and Russia and South Africa and, you know, Sweden and America and all ethnic cultures, all ethnic groups are experiencing the same changes without us having to adapt it to their culture. And we've been wondering, why does that work? And why it works, I think, is because connection is a universal human desire to be connected, to feel connected, to experience that sense of belonging without judgment is a universal human yearning. And when you've got that, then and you have a technology that helps you get that, then that's what you need. And that is the technology is having a conversation that's safe, and you can predict that that safety will and you can predict that safety that'll hang out.
It's interesting. I don't recall ever hearing my father or my mother put the other one down. I just honestly cannot recall ever hearing that. Now, my dad might do that to us. There are certain phrases that I remember him saying to us when we would do something that, you know, I guess to put it properly, he perceived as stupid. But again, we're going back to the key relationship here in a family is the parents.
Yep.
It's not the parents to the kids. I mean, it's yes, the parents and kids are important. But without the parents and they're relating properly, there's no good lessons to be handed down to the children.
Exactly. So,
and I never understood how couples, to the other's face or behind their back, could put down their partner. I don't do that. I didn't do that to my first wife, and I don't do that to my second wife. Because it's like, well, if you don't want to be with her, then don't be with her. But you don't have to, you know, talk smack about her to other people. And I'm sure that you have done this on occasion, Harville. I'm sure that you have shared certain situations that have developed in your relationship with your wife. You know, hey, yeah, I know she's got a headache and she's this and that and the other. And it's not that you're complaining. You're just saying, hey, this is what's going on. She's not available to come to the phone, or we can't get together this weekend, blah, blah, blah. But you're not criticizing her to someone else or to her face. I just never understood that.
Yeah. And, you know, I never saw it either in my early growing up. But, boy, when I went into the field of marital therapy, those were my customers.
Wow.
And when you explore childhood with them, the models of the parental put-downs tend to be there. And then what I began to understand was that also sometimes partners or you know, parents do not behave badly in front of their children, but they behave badly in the bedroom.
Mm.
And that if the parents or partners have a relationship which is a persona for you know, the public world and real but difficult one for the private world, children pick up the parents' realities, whether the parents hide it or not.
Yeah.
That is, if there is any tension, it really comes through. So what's important is that there be congruence for the parents' relationship. That, in fact, it's better for children that parents be open about their differences in front of the children than it is for parents to, you know, have a smiley face in front of the kids and a frowny face in the bedroom.
Right.
Because the children will pick up that incongruity.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Harville Hendricks. He's the author, co-author, along with his wife, Helen LaKelly Hunt, of Making Marriage Simple, 10 Truths for Changing the Relationship You Have into the One You Want. I'm curious as to whether these techniques, they may need modifying, can be used in other relationships, say at work with your coworkers supervisor, etc.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I'm glad you asked that question, because I recently was called by a man and his wife who said they wanted to come and visit me and visit Helen and me. And so and they wanted a 3-hour session, and it was not for therapy. So we said, well, that's unusual. And they came to a workshop and had made a contribution to our scholarship fund for couples who can't afford workshops of $200,000. And said, this is, and we said, why are you doing this? And they said, well, it's because it has saved our marriage. But the reason we are coming to visit with you is to talk about our business. 7 years ago, when our marriage was on the rocks and blah, 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 my business was worth $20 million. Today, it's worth $700 million, and the percentage of the rise is that in 2 or 3 years, I'll be a billionaire, or we'll be billionaires, and we want to thank you for it. I said, well, that's gracious of you. You could have written a larger check. And he said, well, you know, we've got all that in mind. But here's what I wanted to say is I took what I learned from Imago into my business, and it transformed my business. And he says, I have 3,500 employees, and I am here with you to work out a way that every one of my employees can go through your workshop. You don't have to do what I have 300 workshop presenters. So, you know, and he says, I know you can't see them all, and you don't even do that anymore. But I want them all to experience Imago. So the point is, and he's not the first businessman who's come and told me about business transformation as a result of simply introducing conversation, safe conversation or dialogue into that system and removing negativity. And the reason he said is everybody in my business now feels like they're in a family, and the family and the parents in this family care about them, and they now care about the business. And he says, I grow people. I don't grow the business. I grow people, but I didn't know how to do it until I got this stuff from you. So it can go there. We are now distributing it, beginning a real citywide project in Dallas, where we're distributing it to two new communities, the parents of the children in the Dallas Independent School District and to the children and teachers in the school. It works equally well there because safe conversation is something that everybody wants to engage in, to be able to talk without being scared, well, to be able to talk and be heard. And when you do that, you change the whole ecosystem.
What would it take for you to take this to the halls of Congress and the seats of government around the world? You want to talk about unsafe conversation.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, you can't blow your nose without you're a liberal. Oh, you're a Democrat.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just awful.
Put down after put down.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a hard question.
It always is.
Yeah. We can take it into controlled institutions like businesses and schools and churches. We're moving into religious institutions.
What are you trying to say about political institutions? They're uncontrolled?
They're uncontrolled.
That's a beautiful word.
Yeah.
Well, all we can do is hope that as the work that you're doing spreads, as it is, to the citizenry, that new blood, fresh blood, communicative blood will enter the halls and not be contaminated, so that maybe one day we will actually be able to see some work being done in all of the halls of government throughout our land as well as around the world. Because I know if it's like this here, and it's kind of like what you were saying about relationships between couples around the world, you found that basically they were the same.
Yeah. They were the same.
The dynamics were no different than those in the U.S., and that is quite remarkable. It definitely says that we're all connected because we all have the same problems.
Yeah, and I think that the answer, political answer, is that we need to, which is why we focus on couples and healthy families, we need to grow up a new generation of people who have not been wounded in their childhoods.
Mm.
And when they get to Congress, they will not have lost their empathic abilities, and we will then have a new world. But it's not going to change. The world and politics is not going to change until we change the home. And in the home, the couple are the parents. And so that's why we've moved out of just doing therapy into public relationship education, hoping to get more and more of this technology into the families that will never show up for therapy, but might show up in some way on an online course or in a movement or come to a church where it's available for distribution there or in a school. So we have to focus on relationship.
Yeah.
And in contrast to the welfare of the individual, we have to focus on the relationship, knowing that only when we have healthy relationships is the welfare of the individual sustainable.
Yeah. Making Marriage Simple is the title of the book, but it is also the web address, makingmarriagesimple.com. Before we let you go, Harville, let me ask you my final three questions.
Sure.
Who is Harville Hendricks?
Wow. Well, I think a kind of visionary, but happy and grateful human being, that I've been given an opportunity to be here and do this.
What is it that you hope to or want to, and I will include your wife in this, to achieve in the work that you're doing now?
Well, we want to achieve a change in cultural consciousness about the value of relationship, that it is primary and primordial. And shift the culture away from a focus on valuing and eulogizing the individual. So, because if we do that, then we will take care of the individual. But when you take care of the individual at the expense of the relationship, then you have the kind of chaotic culture that we have now.
And to that end, how powerful are we as human beings?
Oh, wow. Well, I think we're as powerful as we can engage other people in the conversation. Because without other people and everybody becoming a part of the new conversation, the new world cannot arrive.
I'll ask a fourth. Are you optimistic about our future as a species in civilization and in relationship?
I am. And I have only one qualifier to that, and it is a fear that the ecosystem may have become too toxic to give us enough time to change the mindset of, you know, have long enough to have a generation of healthy children come from healthy families so that we can actually have a world that takes care of the earth.
Hmm.
I don't know what the earth will do by 2050, and the predictions of it is that it's going to be very difficult by then if we continue to pollute the atmosphere. But if we can save ourselves, if the earth doesn't burp and get rid of us, I have a lot of optimism about what we're able to do as a human species.
Harville, I want to thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to keeping in touch and seeing how things develop in the work that you're doing.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being on today.
I'm Richard Dugan, and we've been talking with Harville Hendricks, PhD. His wife, Helen LaKelly Hunt, PhD, also joined in the collaboration of this and I'm sure many other works, and it is called Making Marriage Simple. Again, the website, makingmarriagesimple.com. I'm Richard Dugan, and you've been listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.